Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this special evening and special guest. Now, we've had some really wonderful people in the music field and the folk and blues music field over the years, including everyone from folks like Christine Lavin to Oscar Brand. I mean, some real legends, Tom Paxton. We've got another icon and legend tonight.
Hello.
Hi, David Bromberg, please.
Yeah, this is David. Thank you so much for trying to... What a difficult night.
Yeah,
my home phone sort of completely died.
Is it icy there, or is it just...
Yeah, it's pretty icy out. The phone companies are not very dependable.
Well, at least that's what cell phones are for, I guess. Well, I'm glad to speak to you, and thanks so much for taking the time out.
What's the station?
It's WGBB in Long Island.
Ah, okay. Is it a Pacifica or a public broadcasting station?
Nothing like that. It's actually a commercial station.
Commercial radio. Hot dog.
God, yeah. One of the oldest radio stations in the country. It's around since 83 years now on Long Island. So it's you know, it's had its ups and downs, but we're still here. And pretty happy about that. So, and my show's been running since 2002. It's called Dave's Gone By. And just really happy to be talking to you. So,
thank you. I'm grateful for your interest. Do you have a good enough signal from me?
It's, I mean, obviously a landline would be better, but it's good enough. You might, the voice is a little but you're certainly listenable. It's okay. And I have your CD, so I won't be playing that through the phone line. So that'll sound even better.
And actually, I'm in a small city, not a small town.
Oh, excuse
me. It's about 70,000 or 80,000 people here.
No, they made it kind of a big deal, apparently, when you moved there, because you got involved in the arts scene when you moved there very quickly. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about that.
The city, I'm not sure if they helped us get here or hindered us getting here, but they wanted us here. And I had some meetings with the mayor, who said that there used to be live music all along Market Street, which is the street that I live on. Excuse me.
In Wilmington, is it right?
I want to cough in your ear.
Sure.
He thought it would be wonderful if there could be live music on Market Street again. So I found a cafe. A large place that was willing to have me host jam sessions there. On Tuesday nights, we did, and we do, kind of acoustic music, you know, kind of bluegrass-oriented, but not exclusively bluegrass. And on Thursday nights, we do electric blues, Chicago-style blues. And that got me really playing a lot.
And you had not... been playing, well, I mean, you've been doing some live gigs for the past few years, and you haven't released any albums in 17 years, and we'll certainly get to that. But there was this period, it says in your bio, that you got a little tired of the whole touring and schlepping and the music biz scene.
Well, I don't know if that's really accurate. It wasn't that I got tired of the music biz scene. The music biz scene is no worse than any other business, really. But I got burnt out with touring. I was touring at an insane level. During one period, I was on the road for 2 years without being home for as long as 2 weeks.
Ooh.
And that takes its toll, and that's what got to me. And strangely enough, I didn't realize that I was burnt out. I thought I just wasn't a musician anymore because I'd get off the road and I wasn't practicing, I wasn't jamming, and I wasn't writing. So I went through a big personality crisis and decided to change my life because I didn't want to be one of these guys phoning it in, you know, reluctantly, you know, going on stage because it was all he knew how to do.
Right. Well, actually, now this leads to kind of a side question. Now, you were known from the very beginning for your skills as a guitarist. I mean, certainly one of the premier names in folk and bluegrass guitar. Is there a point where you get better and better and better, and then even if you practice all the time, you don't get better anymore. You're just trying to maintain your level of skill. And then even after that, it gets harder. Even if you do practice, it's hard to maintain that level. Is that true, or do you feel in some ways you still get better?
I don't think it is true, actually.
Okay.
I think that all of us who spend a lot of time with an instrument have times when we hit these kind of plateaus where it seems very difficult to advance. But if you do keep practicing, you do advance. And there's no end to it. You can never, no one is ever as good as they can be on any musical instrument. There's always more.
Well, when did you pick up the guitar? When was that first moment when, you know, you held one and said, hey, this may be
fun? When I was 13.
Mm-hmm. Bar mitzvah present?
Sorry?
I said bar mitzvah present?
No.
I was teasing.
My brother had played guitar and I had played flute, so I could read music. But I really wanted to play the guitar, but it wasn't until I got the measles.
Oh.
At 13, which is kind of late to get the measles, I borrowed one of my brother's guitars and one of his books, instruction books, a Mel Bay book, and started to teach myself to play guitar.
And did you did you realize that you were improving rapidly or more markedly than, say, other kids who were dilettantes at the piano or the violin? And we'll certainly talk about violins in a little bit. But, I mean, did you feel, oh my gosh, I'm really adept at this?
No.
Oh.
No. I was not one of these people to whom it comes easy. I practiced a whole lot, and, you know, it always seems like the progress is dreadful slow. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it really was slow, but it always feels that way. And there are always people who could do things I couldn't, and I want to be able to do anything and everything on the guitar.
Huh. You're breaking up just a little bit on the cell phone. I hope we don't lose you there. You did know that, I think, by your mid-teens, that music was the way to go because you went to Columbia for a major in musicology to learn about musical history and theory.
Well, I did that because what I really wanted to do was do nothing but play music all the time. And without being told, I understood that I was going to be a professional person. That's what my parents expected of me. So that my compromise was to study musicology. That was acceptable to them, and I'd still be involved with music.
Huh. But really, I mean, when you weren't taking classes, you were just going to downtown New York and hanging out and soaking up what was there music-wise.
I was doing some of that, but mostly I was playing with everybody in and around Columbia. Especially, I had a friend named Ralph Pessa, P-E-S-S-A-H, and we used to play till all hours of the evening out in the quadrangle or in the middle of the street. We didn't care.
Huh. So, and this again would have been in the early 60s? I'm trying to get a time frame on this.
Yeah, this would have been 63, 64.
Now, did you graduate from Columbia? Did you get your...
No, I didn't.
What happened?
I took a leave of absence. I don't know if they take me back anymore. It's been a very long time.
You're probably getting an honorary thing at this point, but a leave of absence to become a musician full-time?
Actually, I took the leave of absence because I was having trouble coping. And so the leave of absence was so I could get my stuff together, you know.
What was so difficult? Were you living still home or were you dorming?
No, I wasn't living in a dorm and I wasn't living home. I was living in an apartment. But, you know, we all have our demons, and I was fighting some demons.
Oh, gosh. Not alcohol or anything like that.
No.
Just personal?
No, just personal stuff.
Did you conquer them somehow?
I think I've learned to handle them a whole lot better.
Huh. How long did it take? I mean, did it follow you all through those early, or did it, you just conquer them like 5 years ago? Or not yet?
I don't know how much I've conquered them, but I've got them to a point where I can manage them.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's wonderful.
It was never addiction or alcohol or anything like that.
Okay. No, so we all have our stuff. You know, I've got some rage issues,
right.
You know.
I got my own baggage.
Yeah. But at least at some point, you when you went through that very difficult period, at some point you were still playing music and sort of got into the big folk scene that was happening. So that kind of puts you
down.
Well,
actually,
nope.
I got into the folk scene, but I was actually playing I made more progress at first on the rock and roll scene. I was playing guitar on a number of different recordings. I mean, I was on a Link Wray record. I was on one or two Jamie Americans. I was recording for as a session player for Mercury for these made-up bands they had, Archie and the Archies and Steam and the Left Bank and all these things. And I was doing some of that before I got...
Sorry, did you play on Sugar Sugar? I have to ask. Were you on that?
I have no idea. I doubt it. But the truth is that, you know, we laid down tracks and we never heard the vocals.
Oh, wow. Okay. So from Mercury, were those bad years, or did you, like Graham Parker, have mercury poisoning, or were you so, you know, just session man, so you weren't even affected by that?
Just a session man. So
okay. Wasn't so bad. So then how did you sort of move into a different circle of musicianship?
Well, I was always interested in every kind of music I heard, and I started hanging out in the village and playing a... I'd always loved folk music, so I started playing with some folk musicians. And the first guy, the first successful professional to hire me as an accompanist was Tom Paxton.
Oh, my gosh.
I was just a guitar player for a little bit.
Were you on any of his albums? Or was this really
yes,
early?
I was on one of his albums on Elektra, and then later I've been on at least two of his albums.
Cool. And if, you know, Paxton was hooked up with everybody else from the folk scene in that era, so you must have been around all those people too. Was it?
Well,
I
ran into this guy who eventually was called Jerry Jeff Walker, although that wasn't what he was called when I ran into him.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of a jazz fusion rock and roll band, but wrote songs that were much more country. And I was Jerry Jeff Walker's guitar player for a few years.
We're talking with David Bromberg on Dave's Gone By. And so far, all the assumptions that I've been making about your career, I have the template from your bio of it, but everything I've assumed, you said is completely wrong. So this is so much fun for me to just have me say, well, this happened, didn't it? And you're like, well, not really. So we might as well just go further with that. And then so once you were in that scene... you hooked up with some fairly major people, and eventually also got a recording contract with Columbia Records.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, that part's true.
Well, the recording contract came about as a result of my being at the last Isle of Wight Festival to accompany Rosalie Sorrells. And we were there on a Wednesday, and the press didn't get there till Friday. However, there were 200,000 unpaid people who had knocked down the fences. There were 200,000 people there.
Wow.
And audiences that don't pay are the toughest audiences. And they booed a lot of performers off the stage, some very good ones. And
you're not going to say who, are you? just
no, it doesn't matter because it wasn't their fault. I mean, they booed Christofferson.
Wow.
You know? And he was on either just before or just after us, I forget. And so it was, you know, broad daylight, and we went up there, and they started giving Rosalie a hard time. You know, her thing is an intimate thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked me to sing a tune of mine, which was kind of a long, funny thing called the Bullfrog Blues that I used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time she ever asked me to do a song in the middle of her set, and the last time, but it was the best time. So I did this song, and the crowd liked me. They liked it so much that when I finished that song, they permitted Rosalie to finish her set and were receptive.
Wow.
And when we came off stage, the promoters approached me and asked me if I'd come back and do more at dusk. I forget whether they said dusk or 6 p.m., one or the other. But at that point, I didn't realize it, but it was an outdoor concert. Dusk is the very best time to perform.
Oh, wow.
So I came back and I said, how many songs would you like me to do? And they said, do an hour. And I don't think I'd ever done an hour. But I got at least three encores. I can't remember how many. But the crowd, I was their guy. I was their pet. I don't know why. they really liked me. And Columbia Records was there recording it. A gentleman named Teal Macero was doing the recording, and he... recommended to Columbia that they sign me to a contract for a very small amount of money.
well, actually, not bad that you're
actually, a tailor. It was like a lot of money at the time.
Can you say how much it was?
It was $25,000.
Oh, well, that's, you know,
So I was legitimate, but you know, I had friends in the village who'd been signed before me for $400,000.
Well, yeah, but your friends included Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary, you know.
Well, not at that point. I hadn't met any of Peter, Paul, and Mary, but I did meet I guess all three of them later.
Well,
and Bob Dylan I met later. I was speaking actually of Bob and Wainwright.
Oh my gosh! Well, that's a nice signing bonus for him. Nice. I didn't realize. Congrats.
He's worth it. I mean, he's wonderful.
Yeah. And he was... Were you also considered one of the quote-unquote new Dylans, or did you avoid that tag, like when your first album came out?
I don't think anybody ever put that tag on me. For one thing, I didn't make a thing out of being a songwriter. I had some of my own songs on the record, but I had a lot of traditional material, too.
Right.
I didn't feel compelled to only sing things I wrote myself. What I developed into perhaps more than a songwriter, although I continued and still continue to write songs, is a band leader.
Hmm. So, yeah, I mean, very quickly after, like, that first album, you already had the David Bromberg band. It wasn't just David Bromberg on the album covers. And you did, like, Howlagen Leah Plagal and a couple of other albums with a full backing group.
Right. Well, I was, you know, even that first album, I had put together a band for it.
Oh, okay.
We recorded the first album in a place called the World Control Studios in Germantown, part of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a band.
Actually, one thing I do have to ask about that first album, which I do love, and to this day do not own on CD, and I'm wondering why. Why has that never been, as far as I know, in this country, released on compact disc?
No, I can't speak for what record companies do or don't do, but it is available in Japan.
Okay.
And at my shows, I sometimes am able to have some of the Japanese.
Oh, the pressings with you, if people want to buy it, that's cool. Because I have to, I mean, just this is one of those moments where radio people get that little moment where they get to talk to someone who's like, oh my God, let me tell you this. And I can tell you that I sang for Margaret Whiting, last song for Shelby Jean. I don't know if you ever heard of her. She's a cabaret songstress of some note.
I know Margaret Whiting. She's not. She died recently, I think.
Oh, my God. Did she? This I did not know.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. I hope she didn't, because she was a marvelous singer.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to someone who was one of her protégés. Aside from you.
Oh, no, I was no protege. It was like a cabaret talent contest, and I was amazed that I made it to pass, like, the ridiculous American Idol-style auditions for it. And then I got to sing three songs, two of my own, and the one song that I chose to do of a cover was Last Song for Shelby Jean. Because I love that.
I'm very flattered.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful song. So, in some ways, I'm a little disappointed over the years that you didn't write more of your own material. You do have one or two songs on the new album. I think we should tell everybody, of course, that you have a new album out called Try Me One More Time on Apple.
It's actually not out yet. The release date is February 27th. Amazon is taking advance orders on it. And I do have some advance copies at my gigs.
So, cool. And people hopefully will be able to, if you can order it now, actually, on Amazon. So technically, you know, go and get it, because it's really cool. And it's a very intimate kind of, I think it's pretty well acoustic all the way through. I've heard most
it's
of it.
It's only me and the guitar all
yeah.
the way through.
And actually, there's
two a cappella numbers.
Well, the Moonshiner. I'm sorry?
There's two instrumentals and two a cappella numbers.
Yeah, I think Moonshiner's a cappella. What's the other one on there? That's
Lonesome Rolling Wolves, which I learned from Rosalie Sorrells.
Oh, wow. And, well, as I was told by the folks at Appleseeds, a couple of the numbers that are getting a lot of airplay on the college stations and the independent stations include the title track, which you wrote, Try Me One More Time, and you also do a very kind of acoustic-y, bluesy, fun, It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry.
You're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB Radio, and this is David Bromberg. And if you don't know who that is, don't worry about it, because I have absolutely no idea who you are.
That was beautiful. Okay, we've got to talk about the Dylan stuff, because every folk and musical guest I get on here, I do have to ask the Dylan question. So how did you guys hook up? You played on a few of his albums. Tell.
I met him at the Bitter End in New York City, and whether he was there to hear me or Jerry Jeff Walker, who I was playing with at the time, I was probably there to hear Jerry Jeff, but he did ask me to play on a couple of his records, and we became friends, and we did some work together, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
Now, is it true that he would want to do a song maybe once, just rush it through, get everybody to know the chords, then the second time would be the take? Or is that just more legend?
I'd say there's more truth than not to that. But I think rush is not a good word to put in it.
Okay.
My feeling is that he really felt that he wanted to get as much of the real spontaneity and spark in everything that he did. So doing it over and over was not on the program. And I think he's right.
And that was okay by you? You had no trouble following the cues?
No, I never had any trouble with that.
But was there ever a point, I mean, at that point, but he was such a genius spirit that he was generally right about his instincts. I mean, whereas later on, let's say, you were wondering, didn't someone in the studios tell him, well, you know, your voice was flat, or you should have done another take on that? Back then, was anybody able to tell him, you know, it was good, but we should go for one more? Or did you all trust him implicitly and explicitly?
Well, I was just the guitar player. I was not producing the sessions.
Right.
Later,
okay.
I did produce something of his, which is yet to be released, but it's kind of interesting stuff.
Oh, what?
And I'm sure someday it will be released. But the period that you're talking about, it was not my place to say you were flat or let's do that again.
Oh, well, sometimes bands have, you know, they'll say, oh, yeah, I hit a wrong note, or, you know, but I guess you knew your place at that time, and we're just happy to be there.
I didn't hit a lot of wrong notes.
Oh, I didn't, okay.
I
didn't mean that personally.
It's just that the tunes that we did were, I understood what the songs pretty well.
Yeah,
and
no,
I also knew that if I did something bad, they could duck me in the mix. Although, the truth is that Bob liked to use, or my feeling, I shouldn't say what Bob likes, you know, only he can say what he likes.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding is that he took the word recording in its literal sense. He wanted to make a recording of what was happening at that instant, which does not mean overdubs and replacing things and so on. You follow me?
Yes, absolutely.
That was always my impression of what he was after, and that's also what I did on my new CD.
Yeah, I mean, it has a very
very
intimate sound. Where physically was it recorded? Your home studio, or did you go a little place in Delaware?
I've never had a home studio. I never wanted to have a studio in my house. But there was a studio in Elkton, Maryland, that my wife's group called Angel Band. It's a wonderful band.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a guitar player in it. And they recorded their CD in this studio called Target Studios in Elkton, Maryland, which is a small town. And I was very, very impressed with the owner and engineer. He, you know, big city talent in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
And his rent got raised or something, and he moved out of the 3-store shopping center he was in to Wilmington across the street from me. So it was very easy for me to go across the street, record for just a few hours, do one or two takes of whatever tune I could think of, and go home.
Huh.
That's how we did the record.
Now, why did you want, I mean, it has been apparently 17 years since her last album, CD. Back then, I don't even know if it would have been an album, or a CD, it might have been an album then, but why suddenly, like, okay, let's lay something down and get it out there?
Well, I did a show, you know, I'd started playing again here at all the jam sessions, and I started doing a few shows over the, as you mentioned, for the past 3 years or so, I've been doing some shows, and I was doing one in Texas with Chris Hillman and Herb Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting around the dressing room talking about, you know, who we learned from when we were coming up, and I mentioned to them that I had been one of Reverend Gary Davis's lead boys. And they asked me if I could play any of that stuff. And so I haven't tried to play anything of his in 25, 30 years, but strangely enough, I could still remember it. And they said, gee, you should be performing that. And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, they're right. I should be performing it, and you know, I should maybe put some of it on vinyl, just to not on vinyl.
Vinyl.
What do they make CDs out of?
Titanium lucite. You know,
yeah, that's
toxic material, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So I figured, you know, if only to lead other people to listen to the recordings of the Reverend, he's no longer alive.
Right.
And there's not that many of us who studied with him. So that was the first idea, and the first things I recorded were a couple of Gary Davis tunes, which are on the CD, Trying to Get Home and I Belong to the Band.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and I've got another Dave on the line with me, and I'm so thrilled and happy to be talking to performer David Bromberg. And we've just been talking about the early years, the later years, the new CD, so much to talk about and so much more. And one of the things I wanted to mention, and this struck me in reading one of your bios, it was great fun a couple of years ago when we had as a guest on Dave's Gone By Al Aronowitz, who's a documenter of that era, especially the Dylan and the Stones era, and he knew some of these people, all these Columbia folks like Miles Davis and also Hendrix from Reprise. I mean, he was in all these circles, sometimes in a rather undergroundy way. But I read that he was at one point your manager.
He was my first manager.
He did not. No offense, but we talked about a whole bunch of stuff, but that didn't come up. What was it like having him as a manager?
It's probably best if it doesn't come up.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's all right. Some things occurred which we both saw quite differently. He was a great writer, and I'm glad that he had faith in me, and I'm sure that he did some very good things for me. But there were some things that I wasn't happy about. And they were both things that he did and things that I did. So let's just leave it there.
Okay, no problem, no problem. I mean, I can certainly see how, you know, with the way he lived his life, and especially in those years, there could be very, very strong ups and downs with him. But was he a connection that got you playing with the Grateful Dead? Or was that separate?
As a matter of fact, he was.
Well, what was that like, dealing with Jerry Garcia and all those folks on the West Coast scene?
Well, I actually ran into... I first played with Jerry at Woodstock. Through the rainstorm, we sat in a tent and played guitar, just the two of us. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, man.
And I was at Woodstock the same as being at the Isle of Wight, to accompany Rosalie Sorrells, who at the time was managed by Al, although I was not. And then later, when I started recording for Columbia and Al managed me, he asked... Dead if they were interested in doing it, and for some reason they were, and we recorded together, and we had some fun.
Now, did you, I think, especially if there's any real music people listening, musicians, kind of wondering if, and I guess as specific as you can get over the radio, where you physically can't see a guitar or the fingering of it, but is there, say, something that you learn technique-wise from a Jerry Garcia, or would you learn from Gary Davis or some of those other folks?
Well, I don't know that I learned anything from playing with Jerry, either because there wasn't anything that I could really take in the time that we spent together,
sure,
or because I was too dumb. I don't know. I did learn a great deal from Reverend Gary Davis, though.
Like what?
I learned how to play his song. Some of his songs.
Okay.
And he had some techniques that were fairly unique to him. He used to play six-string chords with his thumb over the neck of the guitar, playing the two lowest strings. And he used chord formations that I've never seen anybody else use before or since, unless they learned it from the Reverend.
Wow.
And he played with two fingers, and he played these syncopated rolls. In other words, with the two fingers, instead of going thumb, finger, thumb, finger, thumb, finger, he'd go thumb, thumb, finger, or thumb, finger, finger. And that gives us each one of them gives a different kind of syncopation to the triplet that you're playing.
Okay.
And he also used to play with a moving bass against a melody line. And I learned to do that. And he also used to have the guitar say some of the words for him, and I definitely learned that. But the idea of a talking guitar, or at least for me, the idea of a talking guitar came from Rick and Jerry Gates.
Okay, now here's a very kind of dumb radio sort of segue, but I've got to make it. A guitar can talk, and a guitar can gently weep. And therefore, that brings us to George Harrison. Told you it was a bad segue, but gotta ask, because you co-wrote a song with him called The Hold Up that was on your first album. You met him at a Thanksgiving party?
Yes, that's right, at Al Aronowitz's. It was Al and his family and George and myself.
And you hit it off, or did you write the song that night?
Yes.
Oh.
There was one gut string guitar sitting around the corner, and we passed it back and forth without it. I don't think either one of us intended to write a song, but, you know, within about half an hour, we'd written a song.
Yeah. And it's a very fun song. It's one of the most enjoyable numbers on the album. So, just curious, did you keep up any kind of friendship with him in later years, or was it just that night and then you didn't really run into him?
I was in touch with him for a few years, but not in very close touch. And in later years, I haven't spoken to I hadn't spoken to him for quite some years before he passed.
Oh, sure.
But I was able to observe from a distance. He seemed like a much happier guy later in his life, and much more comfortable with himself.
Now that you're kind of back in the groove, how are you balancing the fact that you are touring a bit again and going around? And
I don't know if it's fair to call it touring. I go out for weekends, and I try to limit it to 2 weekends a month.
Oh, so that's half the year, but at least you're two here, two there, instead of going away for 2 years and not seeing your home, pretty much.
Yeah, so I make it a point not to be away from home for very long.
Yeah. I mean, like, hopefully some friends of mine, my wife and I, are going to Merlefest this year, and you apparently played there last year, right?
Yeah.
Are you going to come back or not, or?
I haven't heard from them. I don't know if I'm invited or not.
Oh, sorry. Well, I figure you can just invite yourself to that, but.
Nope.
Okay. Did you have fun? I mean,
I loved it. I had a great time.
A bluegrass thing and a folk thing, and people just get up for a couple of days. It's like its own little Woodstock. Or so far as I know, I haven't been yet, but looking forward to it.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful festival. You'll have a great time.
Getting to on a more general sense, what would you say, you can pick more than one, but like the greatest single moment of your career, like the moment where you just went, I can't believe I'm so lucky in this life that I'm doing what I love to do, and wow.
Well, I should warn you that I'm very bad with overview questions.
Okay.
As a rule, I cannot answer them at all. And there have been so many moments when I felt to be unbelievably lucky. I mean, one was when I was on the stage all by myself at the Isle of Wight.
Absolutely.
Another was a time when I was sitting in with Bob Dylan and his band, and he and I traded verses on a lot, The Last Train to Cry.
Was that at Big Pink?
Together.
Where was that? Sorry?
I'm sorry?
Was that at Big Pink, or where was that?
No, that was in Chicago, Illinois, maybe a decade ago.
Oh, okay.
Maybe not even that long ago.
Wow. And what were some of the other, yeah?
It's hard for me to call them up. You know, there are just too many. Those two came to mind immediately.
Well, that's terrific. Are there things that, over the course of your life and career, I mean, again, not getting into, like, the really dark time.
It sounds like an overview question coming, and I can't answer them. I don't look at things with an overview.
All right. Let's talk violins, then, because that is your main thing. I mean, maybe you're concentrating on the music now because the album's just coming out, and you're doing a couple of gigs.
My life is also quite intensely devoted to violins.
Now, when did that, you were such a guitar person, when did the violin suddenly go like, in your heart and mind?
At a certain point while I was performing, you know, I had played a lot of fiddle tunes, and many of them I learned from fiddlers. So I had a pretty clear idea of what I wanted a fiddle to sound like, so I decided I should learn to play it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And the first fiddle I bought turned out to be an American violin, and I have a collector's bent, so I started collecting violins that were made in the United States. And at the point where I got burnt out, mm-hmm. and I realized I had to start another life for myself, or I felt I had to, I was living in California, and the place where I found things the most interesting, the most intellectual stimulation I got was in a violin shop. So I decided to learn to make violins, and even more, learn to identify them. That was always what fascinated me. How someone could pick up a violin without reference to the piece of paper inside, which is frequently, very frequently incorrect. How somebody could just look at the outside of a violin and tell you who made it, or when and where it was made, or both.
Well, you kind of, maybe it was you who wrote this, or maybe I heard it somewhere else, where one of the things that makes a violin special is you should see, like, the tool markings, or certain kinds of aspects of a craftsman who made it. It shouldn't be just this slick piece of wood.
It's not so much the tool markings, but which tools the maker used and the manner in which he used them.
Mm-hmm.
Many makers, especially the French makers, try and erase any trace of the tools. The French makers tried to make their instruments look like they were created by lasers, whether lasers had been invented then or not. You know, they tried to make perfection. The earlier Italian makers, the greatest violins ever made, do have plenty of tool marks on them. And that's, in talking about my interest in violins and my new CD, which seems like a bizarre thing, but it isn't. You know, for example, the greatest violin makers such as Stradivari, Amati, and Guarnerius, symmetry was not one of the objectives. That wasn't what they were trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Well, sound, I assume, is what they were trying to achieve.
I'm sorry?
Sound, I assume, is...
Sound is part of what you're trying to achieve, but you also want to make something beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to make something that looks like it was put together like a half-wood but sounds great. To make it look good, that didn't entail making it look untouched by human hands.
Okay.
And that was kind of the attitude that I had in making my CD. I didn't care if there were some tool marks showing.
Ah, the rough-hewn kind of feeling to it.
I didn't want it totally rough-hewn. You know, I didn't want it to be, oh, my God, this guy can't sing or play at all. You know, this is really rough stuff. I didn't want it to be like that, but I also didn't want it to sound perfect.
Right.
You know, like a lot of wonderful records do sound perfect, but I find the ones that I like best have plenty of tool marks on them.
So sort of round this all off, you were doing your violin-intensive stuff in Chicago, but then you decided to go to Delaware, which might strike some people as a little bit, well, not necessarily odd, but what happened? What was wrong with Chicago? It's a great town.
Well, we didn't want to face another one of the winters there.
Understood.
And my wife and I are both originally from the East Coast, so in a way it was coming home. And we didn't feel we could afford to live in New York City. And besides, it's pretty cold in New York, so we wanted to get somewhere a bit south of that without being in the south, because we're not really southerners. We ended up being just in Delaware, just barely south of Philadelphia.
And how's the winter been?
It was pretty good till recently, and it's gotten pretty nasty recently.
Yeah, but so is New York, so I'm completely, you know, I commiserate.
And it hasn't been as bad here this year as it was in Chicago, so we benefited a bit from it.
Well, David Bromberg, I'm just having a wonderful time talking to you. So I guess the question I want to go out on, and I ask this of a lot of the musicians, is what do you listen to? Who are the artists? Who's in your CD player or on your iPod, if you're
have an iPod.
Mm-hmm.
And I listen to so many things on my CD player, I don't know where to start.
Is it all in your genre, or do you bounce from, like, hip-hop to, you know, pop to ethnic Ukrainian music?
Well, I do like Balkan music quite a bit.
Okay.
And I think that I listen to a lot of things outside the genre, or the genres, I think you have to use the plural, that I play in. But most musicians are like that. I think you'll find most musicians listen to a wide variety of music.
Well, I hope certainly that the folks listening to this program will want to listen to the new CD from the wonderful David Bromberg. It's called Try Me One More Time on Appleseed Recordings. Do you have a song that maybe we should play to go out on?
Why not Try Me One More Time?
Thank you so much. Best of luck with the CD. Best of luck with playing the title track of Try Me One More Time, David Bromberg.